This is a podcast with Kyle Samani, the co-founder and managing partner of Multicoin Capital. Kyle and I first sat down and had a conversation in Austin in 2022, where we touched upon Solana, high throughput blockchains, and what is now known as decentralized physical infrastructure networks, DePIN. We double-clicked on a lot of those topics today and expanded upon the active networks within DePIN versus the more passive, such as digital commodities, what his point of view is on decentralized compute, and also touched upon his recent essay versus modular versus integrated blockchains. I think it was a wonderful conversation. Kyle's one of the few first principle thinkers that are in the crypto industry and a person that I admire as a manager myself. And last thing before diving into the episode, although our guests this week are managing partners of a registered investment advisory, nothing in this podcast should be considered an offer of Multicoin's investment advisory services or should otherwise be confused for investment, tax, legal, or other financial advice. Kyle, thank you for joining me on the podcast again. I was looking at our podcast that we recorded in Austin about a year and a half ago, and it was amazing to me just what has happened from then to now. And so a lot of interesting tidbits from there, but really looking forward to this conversation. I always feel like I learned quite a bit from you. So thank you for coming on.
Excited to be back on for round number two, Logan. Let's jump into it.
Perfect. Well, I think ultimately you started Multicoin in 2017, but fairly quickly, say 6 months, a year afterwards, we were in a pretty deep bear market. And that, I would say, crypto is prone to these cycles. We're obviously about a year and a half, 2 years into kind of the bear market now. Any kind of just general thoughts on the state of the market and where we are today?
A few thoughts. One, I mean, look, like, it's pretty cliche, but stay positive, keep building, like, things get better. The cyclicality in crypto is extra painful emotionally. So keep your head up. Two, touch some grass. That helps a little bit. Three, you know what? I've been thinking about this market versus last cycle. And I'll say this market cycle to me feels much worse than the last one. Last cycle, there were no expectations. Like the 2017 ICO bubble happened and like the outside world just kind of laughed at crypto. It was like, yeah, you know, like whatever. And then DeFi happened and then NFTs happened. And then like obviously banks and stuff started to do real things. And I mean, Instagram was on the verge of rolling out, you know, NFTs to, you know, a billion people. And obviously that got canned. And so, you know, to me, this bear market feels worse in that people started to pay attention and take it seriously. And I think largely speaking, expectations were not met. Some were a function of product market fit not being there. Some were a function of being too early. Some a function of trust being broken with all the CeFi explosions in 2022. So different contributing factors there. But, you know, as a meaningful participant in the market today, I certainly feel the weight of that. But despite that, I try and make sure I touch grass and stay positive.
Yeah, I think that is important for how much we're actually online. It is remarkable how much getting some sunshine and going outside will actually do for your mental health. But kind of double clicking on your point on whether expectations were not met or the industry did not live up to its promises. Are there anything in particular there, whether it was like the products didn't meet expectations, it was the underlying infrastructure that was not able to kind of scale in a meaningful fashion? Was there anything in there particular that you feel like kind of caused, outside of just number going down, a harder transition in this bear market than the past bear market?
Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that NFTs were a consumer phenomenon, and then like, you know, I can sit here and say, I believe that there will be digital artifacts on the internet and people will collect them. But I think most people in the world don't believe that or don't even have enough requisite understanding to appreciate that. And so, I think part of the challenge is like, it became a consumer phenomenon. a bunch of executives at a bunch of big companies were like, okay, let's figure this out. And then they kind of didn't. And so that's painful. And like watching all of these companies make the same mistakes in terms of what they're doing and the experience they're running. So that's been a little bit disheartening to me. But on the flip side, like there's a bunch of people iterating and innovating on NFTs. There's teams like Tableland that are enabling dynamic NFTs. There's, you know, new art focused exchanges like Wild that are focusing on, I think they call them, what's it called? 3D space collection type things. So, you know, we're seeing people iterate on some of these ideas. Guys like Drip and Dialect are focused on these like large scale drops, which hasn't really been done before. So the experimentation continues. We don't obviously have the right shape yet. But I'm pretty optimistic that we'll get to the right shape. I think probably 10K PFP collections is probably not the right shape. We need to, if Ethereum in 2017, people were like, the killer app is ICOs and fundraising. And it turns out the killer app actually was providing financial rails for DeFi. And so we're kind of still at the 2017 ICO part of that analogy for NFTs. And we're figuring out the DeFi part, so to speak. But I'm optimistic we'll get there. There's a lot of people trying to crack that nut.
Yeah. It was rather remarkable how many people actually came on chain or at least experimented with kind of the culture aspect of NFTs. But I definitely agree we'll see how the 10K PFP morphs over time. But maybe kind of double clicking or on our past conversation in kind of the last like 5 minutes, of our first podcast, you were really excited about this new capital formation that at that point in time, I think your first foray into that venture was with Helium and then ultimately with Hivemapper following. And since then, it's really been kind of an explosion of these decentralized physical infrastructure networks that have really come about. And so I would love to kind of double click on them. I know you kind of segment them into GPS dependent or kind of digital commodities. Can you touch upon how your thinking has really evolved over the last year and a half since you started investing in these decentralized physical infrastructure networks and where you think it will continue to go?
Yeah. So first I'll say we just published our content from the Multicoin Summit. One of the talks is from Shion on exploring some new frontiers in DePIN. So I encourage you to check out that talk. There's also a blog post that we published maybe a few weeks ago exploring some similar ideas. So I think a lot of our leading edge thinking is generally there. From my vantage point, you know, I think my biggest learnings about DePIN have been focusing on things where it's passive. The more active engagement you require from the supply side of the network, the harder it is to make the DePIN capital formation magic scale. So that's been a big learning lesson for us, having observed a bunch of these networks. I think the other thing we've learned is don't overemphasize trying to solve the verification problem perfectly in the early days. It's really easy to get caught up in all the crypto economic engineering around like, hey, did this guy cheat and like earn some inflation unnecessarily? Obviously, you can't make it trivial to bypass, but I generally wouldn't focus on over-engineering. I think most teams tend to over-engineer on that. Filecoin's probably the biggest example of that, where the system is just very complex around the proofs and stuff. So generally, be expedient, move quickly. I'd say my last kind of major learning is, you know, you got to engage your community, and you got to have like a good, voice for the community. DePIN is very much like WAGMI, and like, it's like, hey, we're all going to do this thing that independently any of us doing this thing is stupid, but all of us doing it together is legit and real. And so it's very much like we're all in the same boat rowing together and having someone who is kind of guiding the boat or whatever, right? Or like being the, what's the dude at an orchestra?
The conductor.
The conductor, you know, like Yeah, you need to kind of know how to lead your community.
Yep.
I think that that's super important. I look at someone like Ariel, for example, at HiveMapper, and you know, I actually do have followed the history of mapping for the last 15 years. I've followed the Google blogs and a bunch of people who have written various good stuff on Apple versus Google Maps and stuff. I can't say that I'm a mapping nerd, and quite frankly, being a mapping nerd is not a thing that ever occurred to me as a construct. But like, man, you go follow Ariel on Twitter.
He's got some
this dude is passionate about maps. Yeah. And providing that that kind of north star for the community, I think is really important.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In terms of kind of like the active versus passive, and double clicking on that, passive being example like HiveMapper, where you can just actively kind of put a dash cam in your car and you drive and do your day-to-day task, or would active or passive also in your mind be included into kind of like the more digital commodities with like bandwidth, compute, and storage? It doesn't Yes. totally have to be in a certain point, or matters less whether it's in Miami versus New York or Texas. You can kind of just add it to the network, and over time it will hopefully contribute value.
Yeah, HiveMapper is a great example of being passive. You set up the dash cam and then kind of don't have to think about it anymore. Runs on autopilot. Most of the, you call it digital commodities. I think kind of the term that's coming in vogue is by the Messari guys is DVIN, or Decentralized Virtual Infrastructure Networks. I'll generally defer to the Messari terminology here just to be consistent for the public. The DVIN stuff is all, I mean, at least theoretically passive. Like, it should be set up computer, install software, turn on software, and stop thinking. Obviously, if it's not that, then you want to make sure you get towards that over time, because the only way you're going to scale the supply side of any DVIN network is if that is generally true. And then, yeah, in terms of, you know, the kind of GPS stuff, the different use cases for DPIN or DVIN networks have different sensitivities to GPS. So like, for example, if you consider something like Render, probably the degree of GPS specificity that matters is probably at the country level. Same with, that's probably the country level. Obviously, if you look at Helium and HiveMapper, that's pretty clearly at like the road level, or like the kilometer level, or maybe even less than kilometer level. If you look at Filecoin, like for archival storage, you know, all that really matters is the country for jurisdictional purposes. But then if you start thinking about retrieval markets and CDNs, now, you know, the degree of GPS sensitivity that matters is probably measured on the order of hundreds of miles. Austin, Houston, Dallas, you know, probably it's like the same thing. But you know, Austin versus Virginia is different. So, you know, like you've got, there's a spectrum here of like latency sensitivity. Interestingly, Helium and HiveMapper are at one extreme on GPS sensitivity. I would have thought that, you know, a lot of leading DPIN networks would be less GPS sensitive, just because the more GPS sensitivity there is, the inherently harder it is. Of course, the flip side of that means the harder it is, it means the less that traditional capital formation techniques could solve the problem. And that opens up the opportunity for DPIN. So all kinds of ways you can slice and dice it and think about it. But GPS sensitivity is definitely a big one.
Interesting. And maybe kind of double clicking, I know you're very excited about Render, also kind of what's going on with their recent update to allow new clients. Can you kind of talk about a little bit how the progression of Render Network has gone since kind of Multicoin's involvement with them, and where you kind of see that network going or evolving over time?
Yeah, so we had a chance to get involved with the Render Network about 2.5 years ago. Met Jules and the team and invested a pretty substantial amount back in, I believe, May of 2021. So I've been working with them for a good while. The opportunity there is just awesome. I mean, their relationships in all of LA and Hollywood For all the major creative studios, from Otoy or bar none, like they're best in class. And you know, that demand for rendering workloads has been growing pretty nicely over that period. Obviously, more recently, the AI stuff started to happen, and we kind of had. It's funny, actually, when we first started talking to the team in 21, they were like, "Oh yeah, you know, like we're focused on rendering, but like one day we'll use this for machine learning." And we were like, "Yeah, sure, cool, whatever." Like, yeah, we'll get to that. And then obviously, ChatGPT happened, and we were like, "Hey, I think now's the time." And everyone was kind of in agreement, like, "Hey, now's the time." And as we started to think about compute marketplaces more generally beyond 3D rendering workloads, we came to realize a few things. Probably the most important of which is that compute markets are heterogeneous on both the supply side and the demand side. The base unit of measurement for most compute workloads is flops, or floating point operations per second. And so people talk about like flops for a lot of compute workloads. In the case of render, they talk about, I think they're called octane hours or something. But really that's like a derivative of flop. It's just a different scale of measurement of flops. When you look at AI systems, a new major component comes into this, which is not just the sheer computational ability, but the latency of the memory to the each compute unit. And that's also not a homogeneous construct either. And the impacts of performance vary widely depending on the type of workload. And so we kind of realized was, hey, the types of workloads are going to become more heterogeneous. There's going to be more rendering types. There's going to be diffusion models. There's going to be LLMs. There's going to be lots of different kinds of LLMs. At this point, with Llama being open source, I mean, there's, you know, dozens of these things being forked. And we think that the amount of heterogeneity in base models is going to continue to increase for the foreseeable future. It may consolidate at some point, but at least for the next few years, it seems pretty clear that it's going to increase. And so the demand workloads are changing. The second thing we observed in our heterogeneous, the second thing we observed was, hey, like there's a huge shortage of supply, obviously. People like to talk about, you know, certain types of models can only run on certain pieces of hardware, which is obviously technically true, but I think is a static analysis as opposed to a dynamic one. The primary constraint in the entire technology market today is GPU hardware. Software is by definition malleable. Hardware by definition is not. And so like supply and demand economics suggests that the supply will conform to the available hardware. We've only just started to see this now in the last couple months with Llama 2. But people are now saying, hey, like, can I tweak Llama 2? Maybe I lose 5 or 10% in whatever performance benchmark. But what if I reduce the compute requirement or the memory requirements by 90%? And there's all kinds of these trade-offs that you can make. And a ton of people are exploring this efficient frontier. And so, you know, our kind of insight number two in this market was the software is going to conform to the hardware because the market is hardware constrained. And then kind of observation number three was the hardware is obviously not homogeneous. A100s are different than H100s, which are different than 4080s and 3080s and such. And so if you think the total computational demand is just going to continue to grow at a pace faster than TSMC can build fabs, which in the near term by definition is true because the turnaround time for new fabs is measured in 5+ year increments, then like we need to figure out how to conform the software to the different hardware. And that means that this market as a whole is not going to be homogenous. So we kind of came up with, I'd say, most of those assessments, you know, call it 6 to 9 months ago. I think all of those have more or less borne out correctly. It's still unclear what that will mean, if like there will be one long-term winner or not. But obviously in the near term, that means that there's a lot of, this market will not be homogenous. It will be heterogeneous, and there will be a lot of opportunities out there. We're fortunate to invest in, I think, 3, maybe 4 teams that are focused on compute marketplaces. And I expect we will do more because of the inherent heterogeneity of this market.
In the heterogeneous market for decentralized compute, similar to blockchains, bandwidth becomes a large factor of moving bits around. How does kind of these bandwidth, not limitations, how does bandwidth factor into kind of these decentralized compute versus kind of a traditional server cluster?
I mean, everything is workload dependent. In the context of LLMs, or I should say AI models, I think the public internet is generally not a viable interconnect. NVIDIA bought Mellanox in 2020 for $7 billion for their kind of custom card connection technology or whatever. They rebranded that technology to be NVLink, which is today, if you buy a cluster of A100s or H100s, NVLink is the thing that connects all those things together. It's obviously a very customized networking tool. The latency of NVLink to connect those cards together, I'm guessing, is measured in picoseconds or nanoseconds, like nanoseconds at worst and picoseconds probably at best. And latency over the public internet is measured in milliseconds. Yep. So you're talking about a million to a billion X difference in latency. Given that, like, certainly training, I think, over the public internet is not going to fly ever. I'm guessing there's no amount of software configurations that you can change that will make that the case. For inference, that may not be. I think on inference, you can probably split things up in a more productive way. Again, I'm not an expert in these systems, but I generally think that will be true. For training, it's going to be damn near impossible.
And on the inference, I mean, for example, ChatGPT 3 costs somewhere around like $12 million mark to train the model, but the inference cost of just the API request was like $700,000 per day. So I think long-term, the money, I mean, depends on how many times you retrain the model, but just the inference cost to and from the model is where a lot of the long-term money can be made sustainably.
Oh yeah, without question. The total amount of compute workload for inference will always be much, much larger than for training. Training is just unique because it requires so much hardware to be co-located. And that has very weird effects on the distribution of the market as a whole, especially given that supply and demand are competing for the same hardware today. There's a bunch of teams working on specialized hardware, both for training and for inference. So this will fragment over time and become the market will actually become more heterogeneous as the underlying hardware specializes. But yeah, in a market where they're competing for the same underlying hardware and the training, you just need to have whatever 500 H100s in a room. The costs become very, very unmanageable.
Maybe last thing on the deep end topic, and then I would love to dive into the integrated kind of modular thesis that you recently put out. But I've talked with quite a few people now, and they're recently either more bullish or now starting to deep dive Filecoin. And in your recent talk at the Multicoin Summit, I think you said you hated it, but now you loved it. Can you kind of maybe double click on Filecoin and how it kind of not relates to DeepIn, but share more of your thoughts on why Filecoin is more, or how do you change your mind from kind of hating it to loving it, and what kind of caused that transition?
A few things I think happened. One was the network launched. My general rule of thumb for blockchains is it takes at least 12 months after they launch to become, to do anything. And even up to 24 or so. And I started paying attention to Filecoin about a year ago, which is about 2 years after the network launched. And my assumption was, hey, like, whatever, it was a cool thing and like it's kind of going nowhere. And as I started to dig into the ecosystem, a few things became very apparent. One, the amount of storage on the network was enormous. And two, demand utilization was growing. And I was like, okay, well, that's the core of the thesis, is like store stuff. So there's more space to store and there's more stuff being stored. So that's a pretty good sign. And the rates of growth of those in an absolute terms were pretty interesting. So that got me excited. Two, I learned about the launch of the FVM, which launched on March 14th of this year, Pi Day. And the FVM allows you, is the EVM on top of Filecoin, and it has additional bindings that connect to Filecoin native primitives. So some of those primitives would be things like, hey, is storage provider storing the file they said they would store? And hey, here's block rewards that are going to this storage provider, you know, like route them to this address. So, and obviously as they add retrieval markets and bandwidth markets and compute markets, they'll add those bindings for those functions as well to the FVM. And so what the FVM allows you to do is it allows you to have programmable programmable DVIN assets, basically. And that struck us as like a pretty important breakthrough. And much in the same way that like Bitcoin was there and then Ethereum allowed DeFi to exist. The FVM, I think the Filecoin kind of pre-FVM was kind of inert, and now post-FVM is dynamic. And so I'd say those kind of combination of things are the things that like I looked at Filecoin about a year ago and was like, hey, like something is here. In the 12 months or so, we've been kind of closely following the ecosystem. You know, we've had a chance to attend a bunch of Filecoin events, get to know a lot of members of the team. We have made our first investment that is like explicitly a Filecoin native team. Can't announce it yet, but we got the deal done, and are looking at a bunch of others. And so gotten pretty intrigued at the intellectual capital that's accumulating in the ecosystem. It's definitely real. And most importantly, it's differentiated. All the people who are building around Filecoin, just like they're not degens like at all. They're like typically storage and distributed systems people. And so they come to things with a very different mentality and mindset. So that's kind of been, I'd say, our 180 on Filecoin in a few minutes summary.
And on the demand side, I think a lot of people that have started to peer their head into the decentralized physical infrastructure networks see how the tokens incentivize the supply, but are still either struggling or not thinking long-term enough on the demand side. Can you talk or share some of your thoughts on bootstrapping not only the supply side, but the demand side of the network?
Yeah, I mean, generally, bootstrapping demand is a completely different activity than bootstrapping the supply. Bootstrapping supply is kind of the core of DPIN, and obviously token incentives help make that capitalist cycle work. The demand side is pretty hard to talk about in general terms because like the demand side of Helium is totally unrelated to the demand side of Hivemapper, which is totally unrelated to the demand side of Filecoin or Render. So hard to generalize other than to say, know your customers, know what they want. In general, most customers for these systems are going to say, hey, how do I have an SLA when I'm facing this decentralized network kind of a thing? So be prepared to have a good answer to that and understand which segments of the market are okay with that answer and which segments are not. And then obviously focus on, benefits, right? Like what's unique. Maybe it's cost, maybe it's verifiability, maybe it's lower latency, whatever, but we'll be very, very clear of the benefits of the DPIN model. I would not highlight DPIN itself. Customers don't care about the DPIN part. DPIN is just the capital formation part. What they care about is the attributes of the system, lower cost, improved performance, whatever.
Makes sense. Cool. Well, kind of moving on, you wrote a very good essay, ultimately breaking down some of the assumptions that the modular community has really put out into the ethos versus integrated chains. And I think it was very well articulated, really kind of around the first principles of what make blockchain scale and really kind of what drives fees. And I think it's very concrete that it's actually not modular that makes fees lower. It's really state contention and bandwidth. And I think that was ultimately just a narrative that got put out into the crypto universe fairly well and kind of has stuck around. What was kind of some of the reception towards your essay, and has any new information kind of come to light that has changed any of your mind after publishing it?
Yes, I published it about 2 months ago. You know, there's a famous saying, Cunningham's law, which I used to employ. I really no longer try to employ it, although some of my critics may suggest that I am still explicit in it. But Cunningham law states, the right way to get a question answered on the internet is not to pose a question, but to pose the wrong answer. Based on this blog post, certainly got a bunch of commentary back from the folks at Celestia, primarily Nick White, and then Neil Sawani, who is building Eclipse, which uses Celestia. They walked through a bunch of kind of very specific technical, details on why my post was wrong or incomplete or something. I won't rehash those other than to say, go listen to my podcast with Nick White and go look at the TweetStorm Twitter thread with Neil. Went back and forth. My general takeaway after getting a lot of, you know, pretty critical feedback from the folks on the other side was that my core arguments are correct, if not perfectly technically, that they are practically correct in the ways that matter. And I'd say looking at, you know, just like gas usage spikes on Base, on Arbitrum and such, even in the 2 months since then, kind of reaffirms those core views. So overall, views have not meaningfully shifted, but certainly have gotten lots of colorful feedback.
As I think we get lots of feedback on Twitter when we love to share some of our more controversial ideas, but maybe kind of double clicking into kind of the first principles of what actually causes fee spikes. One is kind of just how much bandwidth or how big are the blocks? Are those blocks saturated? Once you hit saturation, fees ultimately start to spike. So if you can either increase blocks or make faster blocks, more block space, you don't have that problem. And then when two people ultimately try to access the same piece of state, someone has to access it first. And so you have some state contention. Do you feel like ultimately over the long term in kind of like maximizing bandwidth or data propagation, we'll go to, I'd say today, kilobytes to megabytes, ultimately FireDancer targeting gigabytes? Where do you see like the end state of this? Do you feel like it's a continuous kind of always maximize the data throughput at the base layer? Or at some point, I think in our past podcasts, we talked about you can only move atoms so fast around the world, and that's kind of some limitation there.
You can only move bits so fast, which would be at the speed of light. Atoms substantially slower than the speed of light. If atoms are moving at the speed of light, that is terrifying. That is a lot of kinetic energy. I'd say, you know, the way my thoughts are evolving here, both general approaches will coexist. The Solana approach will continue to focus on maximizing throughput and by leveraging parallelism and customized networking. And then you'll have a bunch of people doing you'll have a lot of Celestiums or Celestias or EigenDAs or whatever. Maybe they'll all be restaked, I don't know, using EigenLayer or something, which theoretically like makes everything, you know, tied to ETH's economic security, kind of, sort of. So that's like one way it can play out on the modular side. I think there's a lot of open questions if that will actually work in practice. I mean, certainly you can theoretically piece those pieces together and say it will work. And obviously I don't think anyone is breaking the laws of physics by suggesting it can work. But I think there are a lot of social configuration problems that we haven't even started to address because most of those systems aren't in production in any meaningful way. So, you know, we'll see, like, does the market care if you have 3DA layers or 50 or 500? I don't know. What does that mean for bridging in terms of latency, gas cost, trust minimization, et cetera? You know, are people going to fork Optimism, OP Stack, and Arbitrum Orbit and whatever else? And are those changes going to be meaningful? And then if so, how does that impact the respective bridging in those systems? So there's a ton of open questions there that are like, we aren't really going to be able to answer them definitively for probably another 2 or 3 years, perhaps longer. So I'd say it's just hard to say. Obviously, there's a lot of human capital trying to solve these problems, but the number of variables is very, very large, and those variables, the answers to each of those variables are tied to, like, the system is very path dependent, so really hard to reason about it specifically. Both models will obviously coexist, but it's not even a question which model will be the simpler model for the outside world to understand.
Do you feel like outside of the kind of maximizing the data throughput at the base layer and isolating fees with local fee markets, once those are kind of implemented, do you feel like the biggest differentiations from the modular thesis to kind of the integrated thesis is that social component, is reducing complexity overhead on the engineers, all the different connections that are being made outside of purely the technical point of view?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think most people underestimate the social costs pretty substantially. I mean, even things like, right, when you want to go build on Solana or on Aptos or whatever, you don't think about questions. Like, data availability is not even a word in your vocabulary that you think about at all. Do you want to tweak the EVM? Which EVM fork do you want to use? Like, those are questions you don't think about at all. There's a lot of these things that add a tremendous amount of time and complexity to the development cycle. That people don't want to think about. Modular maxis will say these are important for application performance tweaking. And my view is, you know, look, man, like, Windows and Mac make a lot of decisions on your behalf, and you definitely agree with 97% of them. And, like, yeah, maybe you disagree with 3% of them, but, like, there's value in the fact that the world standardized on, like, those two things. I think the same will be true here. You can always gripe about how some thing in the operating system or in the blockchain handles something in a way you don't like, but the value of standardization, I think, is extremely valuable.
It is, I think, hard to imagine a world where the demand for block space is even in 50,000 or 100,000 and the daily active users is 10 million or 100 million. We're just very far from that world today. And these complexities haven't really shown face because we're really so small in terms of adoption. Do you feel like, I mean, ultimately these pieces are in place, networks like Solana and the high throughput networks don't have these issues that earlier networks, smart contract platforms have. What do you feel like on the application layer needs to have happen to take us forward? Is it kind of next NFT iteration bull market? Is it kind of more proliferation and deepened markets? Is there any specific user applications that you're excited or looking for?
If you're talking about, like, what's going to drive, like, you know, 10,000 TPS of block space demand, it's kind of how I'm interpreting the question. A lot of things that could be. One could be, like, large scale NFT collecting, like artifacts across the internet. I think teams like Drip and Dialect are kind of slowly moving in that direction. I think that behavior is probably still a few years away, but I think we're moving towards that. Trading is the other obvious one, especially if you have an order book on chain. Obviously, that produces a good bit of block space demand. I think the reason Solana actually doesn't have as much block space demand for on chain order books is because there's just not that many assets people want on Solana. I think that's changing here pretty rapidly. A bunch of teams are launching tokens. Jito, Drift, MarginFi, Jupiter, Zeta, a bunch of these guys. So I think that'll quickly change, which will be great. Render is about to come to Solana. IONET and others are going to launch tokens too. So that'll increase demand for block space pretty substantially. And then the other area is payments. You know, today USDT on Tron is huge all over the world. I think there's a bunch of people who are starting to work on things that you could, like, broadly call global Venmo or some sort of DeFi neobank, basically enabling people to have dollars on chain but still live their lives interacting in local fiat in whatever market that they're in. I think that that's going to grow. I think that's going to accelerate pretty substantially in the next few years. The core infrastructure is there to facilitate this. For on-ramps and off-ramps, the stable coins are there, the wallets are there. So I'm pretty excited about this opportunity. And I think that's going to drive a ton of demand for block space in the coming years.
Yeah, the tokens, especially on Solana, has been historically not the place. But I truly believe that it's primarily just a time function. Solana, just being around less than kind of the Ethereums of the world, is really kind of coming into its own. I think a lot of people were hesitant or had reservations after FTX, what was going to happen. Clearly, I think the Solana community is having its like 2018, 2019 moment where everybody's rallying around it. And it's very interesting now that these teams are kind of coming into age, the products are becoming more robust, and by having these tokens, more liquidity coming into the network as well.
That's right. I mean, a lot of these Solana teams just were early, and you know, I'm actually kind of glad they didn't launch their tokens in the bull market. So you know, now's the opportunity, and you know, they're mature. They've got products, they've got human capital, they've got strong investor bases, they've got good brands, and now soon they will also have good tokens.
100%. Has your kind of thought process around, not modular specifically, but Ethereum changed at all over time? I think Ethereum has become obviously the first smart contract platform. When people kind of think about entering the crypto ecosystem, at least today, the EVM and layer twos are top of mind. Has your thoughts around that ecosystem or even layer twos changed in any meaningful way over the last couple of years?
One word answer is no. The more nuanced answer is you know, the Ethereum Foundation has a fundamentally different set of optimization goals than Solana Foundation. Solana Foundation has a few. One, North Star is on-chain CLOB. Two, internalize complexity into the protocol so that you minimize complexity exposed external to the protocol. Three, there's a third one that was just on my mind. Shoot. Maximize use of available hardware. I'd say those are probably like the major ones. Oh, and four, like not necessarily to run validator at home. And maybe one more that just slipped my mind. Anyways, I'll stick with those for now. Maybe one more I'm missing. And I'll contrast those with like the values of the Ethereum Foundation, which are run validator at home. Minimize complexity internal to the protocol. Vitalik, Justin Drake, a bunch of the others have been very clear publicly. Like their goal is to minimize the complexity of the protocol and to push the complexity up and out. Three, there is no North Star application that they're optimizing for. And so, you know, those optimization vectors are substantially different. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that has changed in like the meta of the market in this, you know, Multicoin just turned 6 years old a week ago. And in the 6 years I've been doing this, the biggest change in the meta of the whole market, in my opinion, has been the zeitgeist has shifted from money crypto to tech crypto. Or in simpler terms, from like Bitcoin is the only thing and everything else is a bunch of shit coins to, hey, like there's an opportunity here to rebuild amazing parts of the internet infrastructure using these technologies. And that zeitgeist shift, I believe will continue. I don't think the money crypto, I don't think this pendulum is going to swing back in the other direction because of the sheer number of the quantum of human capital all over the world building cool shit on Ethereum and Solana and whatever else. And so assuming that progression continues, the system that is like, generally speaking, optimizing for maximizing the tech application functions is the one that's going to be best positioned in the long run. the Ethereum ethos encapsulates a lot of the, I'll call it money crypto ideas from Bitcoin. Not all of them, but certainly some of them. Solana, the only really things that it carries forward are public key cryptography and permissionless consensus. And like, besides that, like all other assumptions have been thrown out. I mean, even the notion of time in the system, like Solana approaches differently, proof of history versus block updates. So yeah, the things guiding the development of these systems have been totally different for a long time. Those differences are starting to become, the implications of those differences in design philosophies are starting to become apparent to the market. I think more and more people will come out on the tech practicality side of that than the money idealized side of that, which I believe is quite favorable for Solana and Aptos and other integrated systems.
I fully agree with that. And I think it has been interesting how long it has taken the market, like even today, to realize some of the things that you and the multi-coin team kind of identified early on with parallel processing, with needing high throughput, being able to allow more flexibility for engineers to create, I would say, more unique applications when you give them a larger sandbox to play in, when you have more data availability to build more interesting applications like a central limit order book. Do you feel like as that window continues to shift from money crypto to technology focused crypto and what type of applications you can build, once kind of the users come in, once it's demonstrated, look, new primitives are allowed to be built here or can be built here, that window of kind of the kind of shifts from the early iterations of smart contract platforms to these more high throughput integrated chains?
I'm sorry, Logan, what was the question? I didn't really follow the question.
How, I guess, like, why, what will be the shift? Today, the landscape is very Ethereum focused, EVM focused, layer twos. If you talk with people outside of kind of our point of view, they think it is not only certainty, but without a doubt that the Ethereum has kind of won this landscape and that these integrated high throughput chains have not lost, but there's some interesting things, but it is very clearly to them not as active as the Ethereum world. I think you and I are very aligned to that the Solanas of the world, the high throughput chains, are going to be unique and allowing developers to build new things. But what will be the catapult for that kind of Overton window shift to these high throughput chains?
The way that the Overton window shifts is the market cap of Sol and Aptos increasing versus the market cap of ETH. As I like to say, the most important feature of a token is its price, or its market cap. I don't mean that in the cynical interpretation, but rather the optimistic interpretation is, broadly speaking, the higher the market cap of something, the more legit the company is. And this is kind of universally true. Apple is more legit than Peloton, right? Like, because the market cap of Apple is like 50x or 100x, whatever the market cap of Peloton. Not to say that Peloton's not legit or whatever. I'm just picking on them, but you get my point. And the same holds true in crypto. Bitcoin is more legit than Ethereum. Ethereum is more legit than Solana, et cetera. So then the upstream question of that is, well, what causes the market caps to, basically the price of the Sol ETH ratio to go up? I think the answer to that is high profile applications that people can see, very definitively. We have DeFi is cool, but like it's also just a casino. It's just circular money, like levering up to buy more DeFi tokens. As Tushar likes to say, DeFi is a second horizon activity, not a first horizon activity. If you look at the evolution of the GDP and the economy of the world over the last 2,000 years, finance was not the first thing that was invented. The first thing that was invented was like trade might, shoes for food or whatever. And like, you know, finance started to be, you know, emerge after the 1400s with the Medici family, but really modern finance, like joint stock companies and stuff like 1700s. And then obviously industrial revolution is when like it started to really become a thing. And crypto is funny because like we invented crypto rails and we're like, cool, what economic activities here? I don't know, but like we can trade shit and lever up. So crypto just like kind of did the inverse of like human history there. But as we undo that, or I should say as the kind of world returns to its normal arc of economic activity preceding finance, that will, I believe, drive the relative ratios of Sol ETH to higher.
Number go up is unfortunately or fortunately the best marketing crypto. It is a signal not only to engineers but also traders. Everybody kind of follows along. I think luckily, at least in my crypto world view on Twitter, it definitely seems like the sentiment is changing, and it truly reminds me of kind of the Ethereum moment in time where 2018, 2019, that community rallied around and really built the core backstop of what happened in DeFi summer and then ultimately catapult us into the next bull market.
Yeah, I mean, I believe Uniswap launched November 2018, like absolute Pico bottom, right? So it's funny how beautiful things tend to emerge at the Pico bottoms.
True. In terms of maybe shifting the conversation a little bit, Multicoin is really famous, and I think you specifically, for kind of that first principles type analysis and continuously breaking down things into their core primitives. I love that style of thinking. I think ultimately it highlights a different point of view in the world that many have a hard time seeing. Case in point, integrative chains versus modular. But I'm curious, are there examples where you felt like something was obvious, but in hindsight, maybe it didn't work out as you anticipated?
I mean, lots of things have worked out as we anticipated. I guess the one I'll highlight here is, well, I mean, we're probably most famous for EOS. So I guess I'll stick with that one. I got into crypto in 2016 because of Ethereum. At the time, the word DeFi didn't exist. The word permissionless finance didn't really exist either. But when I learned, you know, how I could program Ethereum, the construct of permissionless finance entered my head, although I could not describe it in that eloquently, nor did I appreciate the implications of it. And then launched Multicoin in 2017. And I remember vividly, I was at DEF CON 3 in Cancun in November of 2017. This was Pico top. Vitalik gave the keynote at DEF CON 3. He had published a Plasma paper about two or three, it was, I believe, August 1st, 2017, if I recall, or thereabouts. And obviously, everyone was talking about scaling. Like, it was all everyone wanted to talk about was scaling. And Vitalik's keynote had nothing to do with scaling, nothing to do with sharding. It was like a history of Ethereum or something. And I remember I like left and I was like, what is this? Like, since before Ethereum launched, they were talking about scaling. Like at this point, Ethereum is 2.5 years old. And like all eyes are on Ethereum, you know, like it's November 2017. And like not addressing at all, like the thing that everyone is thinking about. And that's when I was like, okay, like I need to revisit my priors. And so did that. And at the time, Solana was maybe an idea in Anatoly's mind, but maybe not even that yet. And EOS was around and looked at the other things that were, I guess Tezos was around, although it hadn't launched, and I forget what else was around at the time, but dug into a bunch of stuff and kind of got convinced that EOS was, a very ideologically different approach and a very technically different approach, basically the opposite of Ethereum in a lot of ways. And so got excited about that and ended up, you know, making a big bet there that ended up flopping pretty bad. But what we learned from EOS was not that the thesis was wrong, but that the team didn't execute. And so stuck with the thesis and ended up working out later. So lots of fun learning lessons on EOS.
I guess as a fund, I mean, it highlighted to you that the thesis could be cracked, but the team or just the ability to execute is not cracked.
Totally. I mean, being the guy who invested in Halo or in a bunch of other Uber clones, you know, is just like intellectually very painful. I mean, even like Tumblr, like I look at USV, they invested in Tumblr and Twitter. Not that Tumblr was a bad outcome and not that Tumblr ended up working, but like, man, if you were in Tumblr and not in Twitter, like, man, you would have been pissed. You know, like thesis right, execution wrong.
Yeah. I guess in terms of just, I mean, being starting Multicoin 6 years, outside of that, are there any big lessons, I would say, one, selfishly, for kind of emerging managers that you could highlight? And two, on the flip side for founders, what are some real world examples or feedback that you could give them to either raise in kind of these more challenging times, or just advice in general to founders?
Say for emerging managers, know your strike zone. It took us a while to figure out our strike zone. Be open-minded about stepping out of your strike zone. And if you are going to step out of it, A, limit it to a fairly small percentage of your fund, and B, very eyes wide open about how and why you're stepping out of your strike zone. But, you know, 90 to 95% of your fund should be in your strike zone. And be very clear about what that is. It took us a while to appreciate that, both at the firm level and the fund level. For founders, biggest piece of advice is stay lean, man. Like, macro can stay worse than you expect, longer than you expect. Or I think, as the famous Warren Buffett is, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So be frugal, be lean.
Good advice on both ends. Well, I truly appreciate you coming on, Kyle. Every time I really do, I feel like I learn a lot, and I really believe the culture that you built at Multicoin has allowed the firm to identify unique things ahead of other people, which to me is just fascinating. I think it's a very interesting way of thinking. It's not always fun, as we talked about in the last podcast, but it, in my opinion, allows you to view the world differently. And I think as an investor, that's very important. Is there any particular things that you would like to highlight that you're either looking forward to in the next couple of years that you are uniquely excited about, or just kind of your mind is open to?
Thank you for that, Logan. A little flattered. We're very fortunate to work with great founders and have a team that gets to learn from the founders. We do a lot of thinking internally, but I'll say a lot of our thinking is inspired from our conversations with founders. So thank you, founders, for providing inspiring thoughts. In terms of what I'm looking for coming ahead, I mean, we tend to be fairly drawn to what I'll just kind of loosely call intellectual capital. So, you know, unique thinking in some form or fashion. I think there's a lot of opportunities around in payments around the world, in DPIN. So we're spending a lot of time on that stuff. Consumer, there's a lot of people running experiments around social and other kinds of weird consumer loyalty things. We certainly have been fairly active there. We did Blackbird. We did Unlonely. We've done, I don't know, a bunch of things I can't even recall right now. Farcaster. So we're spending a lot of time on consumer. We want to figure it out. I think there's going to be some big consumer hits in the next few years. So we're digging deep and looking for founders who have those unique insights.
Perfect. And where can people get in contact with you or the Multicoin team?
Yeah, you can just email me. You can just kind of guess my email address. It's not very hard. Or you can just ping me on Twitter. My Twitter is my name, at Kyle Samani, KYLESAMANI. My DMs are open.
Cool. Well, thank you again for coming on, Kyle. Always a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, Logan.
Thank you.